Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science. I'm Susan Lee Bell at St. Joseph's University, and today I'm joined by Dr. Melissa K. Mary, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Louisville, to discuss her new book, Warped Narratives, Distortion in the Framing of Gun Policy, published by the University of Michigan Press in 2020. Welcome to the podcast, Melissa.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Your book argues that gun policy debates in the U.S. are warped because policy groups systematically distort the problem of gun violence by focusing on atypical characters and settings. Before we explore the argument and the methodology, I want to just ask you a little bit about how this project connects to your previous work, you know, your 2014 book, Framing Environmental Disaster, interrogated the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill, and it has a policy angle, and it is also talking about framing. How did you come to write this book on gun policy, and what are the connections and maybe some of the differences in the two books?
Okay. So I consider myself a policy scholar. I'm interested in the policy process generally. So I have looked at different issues over time. So in earlier research, I looked at environmental policy. And then in this book, I focus on gun policy. And throughout my research, sort of one common theme is the role of language and framing. So I've always seen framing, or how we talk about issues, as sort of fundamental to how the policy process plays out. And I've always been interested in interest groups and how they use framing to try to influence the policy process. So there's some continuity from the previous work in environmental policy to this project. I'm also interested in focusing events. So with my previous book, I look at the Deepwater Horizon oil spill of 2010 to examine how interest groups framed that event, given that there are different ways of interpreting it, and how did they attribute blame for that disaster. Mass shootings constitute a very different type of focusing event, one that draws our attention to the problem of gun violence. So after I wrapped up the project on environmental policy, I really wanted to turn my attention to this area to explore how this policy issue is framed. My argument is a little bit different from the previous book, in that I focused in that book on blame attribution. In this, I'm more interested in sort of the general contours of the policy debate, because I observe that it seems that the ways that we talk about gun violence don't do the entire problem justice, in that we're really oftentimes just focusing on one small facet of the problem. And that's how I got to this concept of the policy debate being warped.
At the very start of the book, you talk about the challenges of writing on guns, the challenge of being asked by family or friends So where do you stand on guns? And I, as somebody who's written on the Second Amendment and been asked some of these questions and read a lot of prefaces in which scholars feel the need to either confess that they are pro-gun, anti-gun, they've fired a gun, they started the process and they didn't believe in guns and they ended their research and they did. I wonder what you think in comparison to working on environmental policy about writing about guns and the reaction that you get both from people in your personal and in your scholarly life.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. I live in southern Indiana, so right outside Louisville, Kentucky, and a lot of people own guns, and I sort of live out in the country, and it's very common to hear the sound of gunfire because people, you know, they just shoot their guns. So when people, you know, acquaintances ask me about my research and what I do, it seems to raise red flags. They are wondering what my, you know, the initial instinct is, well, what's your view on gun control? And I sort of recognize that they are potentially coming from a different place than I am coming from. So it's just sort of a very touchy subject, and I'm always aware of that. Probably more so in talking to non-academics. Academics tend to sort of recognize that the way that I approach the subject matter. I acknowledge that I have my own personal biases, but I'm really sort of interested in examining the issue from that sort of academic perspective, looking at sort of both sides of the issue, so to speak, and trying to come up with some generalizable knowledge that we can use to understand the policy process a little bit better. Academics get that. People who aren't in academia maybe don't quite get that so much. And so their first instinct is to just sort of dive into the issue. And I'm always sort of hesitant to do that.
Well, and I'd say you're being just a tiny bit modest because many academics, particularly in history, have actually gotten themselves in an enormous amount of trouble given that their research was, it appears, too attached to a particular position such that it skewed their judgment. I'll just put it vaguely there. And this book, I think actually very much like The Positive Second Amendment by Joseph Blocker and Daryl Miller, Kristen Goss's books as well, are really trying to approach guns not from this kind of polemical place, but from a place of scholarship. And I really think this book succeeds, and that's a hard thing to do. You start, though, with a puzzle, which I think is a good way for us to get into the argument and the methodology, which is that you say that, you know, gun violence in the United States has had enormous costs. Roughly 35,000 people are killed by guns each year. And you point out that the government has been legislating on this for quite some time, most seriously since the Gun Control Act of 1968, which expanded licensing and shut down access, prohibited sales to certain categories of citizens. But as you point out, even with the legislation, there hasn't been a decrease in gun deaths. And you start with this problem of, well, if gun violence is such a problem, why don't we see more effective solutions? And I thought maybe we'd start with that question as to why these narratives matter so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there really hasn't been any major federal gun legislation since the mid-1990s. And we have this, you know, this incredible problem with 35,000 gun deaths every year, and the number of gun injuries every year is at least twice that. So why haven't we made a more serious dent in the problem of gun violence? And there's some usual explanations for this. One is the power of the National Rifle Association, which has about 5 million members, and it has been incredibly politically powerful in stopping any new gun regulations. And then another facet of this debate is the degree of political polarization. So policy positions on guns are very entrenched and polarized between Democrats and Republicans, and this is only increasing. So the prospects for any kind of legislative compromise on guns are very, very slim to none. So those are some of the usual explanations, and I don't dispute those factors. In fact, I think those are very important. However, I'm also drawing attention to another, what I call more general dysfunction of the policy debate, and that is how it's sort of the way we talk about the debate, the way we frame it. So I argue that the policy debate is distorted or warped, meaning that the ways that we talk about the issue don't accurately reflect the nature of the problem. And there are many political actors who contribute to this, and it's a process that happens over time through the accumulated framing choices of elected officials and commentators and members of the media and interest groups. And of course, I focus on interest groups specifically. And I argue that both gun control and gun rights organizations are doing this, in that they are emphasizing atypical or unusual characters or settings in their policy narratives. So in particular, gun control groups typically highlight white victims, child victims, and they disproportionately emphasize mass shootings in suburban locations. Gun rights organizations, they primarily focus on self-defense situations or shootings like home invasions or robberies in which sort of law-abiding citizens are targeted. And this is problematic because both types of organizations rarely mention the role of race in gun violence, even though gun violence disproportionately affects racial minorities. And both types of organizations rarely mention the leading cause of gun fatalities, which is suicide. So about 60% of gun deaths are from suicide. And that's just not reflected in the rhetoric of gun policy organizations. So this is a problem because it leads to widespread misperceptions of the nature of the issue. And that can undermine any effort to successfully address the root cause of the problem.
And in the book, you do such a wonderful job of showing the nuances of both sides and how, in fact, they both do this. I think people are quite familiar with the idea that the NRA is a powerful interest group and that it has a certain language of citizen protectors. There's been a lot of work done on that, but you do a really good job of showing how both sides are manipulating the narrative in order to highlight one or another aspect. And when you talk about warping and the consequences, you're very careful to separate policy and the political consequences and then bring them back together. So could we start with the policy consequences of warping and then move to the political?
Right, absolutely. So in terms of policymaking, the way we talk about and understand a problem is going to have consequences for the solutions that are considered and ultimately adopted. So if we're just focusing on one small facet of the problem, then that might be reflected in the solution. For example, so in the wake of, there was a shooting in 2011 in Tucson in which Representative Gabby Giffords was severely injured. And the perpetrator in that shooting used a semi-automatic weapon, and it had a 33-round magazine. So after that shooting, people started talking about banning large capacity magazines. A proposal like that, that might have had an effect in that particular instance in that particular shooting. But does it really address the root cause of the problem? It certainly is not going to have an impact on the problem of suicide. So you're just looking, it could lead policymakers to focus on just one small aspect of the problem, but not really tackle the root of the problem. So that can be problematic in terms of figuring out what is the most effective solution to really make a dent in these massive numbers in terms of deaths and injuries that we have in the United States.
And what about the political? How do you see the political consequences and warping?
Right. So I argue that the political consequence, there are several different negative political consequences of warping for interest groups. So it makes it hard for them to build diverse and broad-based coalitions. When gun control groups focus on mass shootings or gun rights groups focus on self-defense shootings, and they're prominently focusing on white victims, that could definitely alienate African Americans who feel that their own suffering is being ignored. It could alienate people who are concerned about other causes of gun violence, like suicide. In addition, when groups are speaking in such different terms about the issue, this reduces the prospects that they'll be able to compromise. They're sort of, in other words, they're talking past each other. They're speaking two different languages. And so the possibility of them coming to a common understanding is diminished. I also argue this can fundamentally fuel distrust between opposing sides. And this comes about in part when there is a mismatch between the framing of the problem and the solution being advocated. So, for example, if a gun control group uses a mass shooting as an opportunity to advocate for something like expanded background checks on gun sales, let's say the perpetrator actually passed a background check, and so in that instance, it wouldn't have prevented the person from acquiring weapons. This could lead people to question the group's motives and ask whether they have some sort of hidden agenda. And this is especially problematic for gun control groups. For a long time, gun rights organizations have argued that gun control advocates won't stop until basically every gun in America is confiscated. So there's already sort of this baseline level of distrust directed at gun control groups. And gun control groups are especially susceptible to the criticism that focuses on this something called a futility argument. The futility argument is that gun laws just don't work because criminals don't obey the law. And so when gun control groups focus on mass shootings and they advocate for these narrow incremental solutions, they sort of open up, they open themselves up to this criticism that they are advocating for solutions that are futile and that they just won't work.
So with the distrust as high as it is in this incredibly polemical debate, does that mean that narratives have even more meaning? Is that part of what makes them so hotly contested and extreme?
At this moment and in the past several years, I think the policy debate has gotten even more emotionally heated. And that's part of what makes narratives so powerful. Narratives transport us. They evoke emotional responses, fear, anger. And that's why they are influential or can be influential, right? So interest groups are trying to harness the emotional power of narrative to shape public opinion to their advantage.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about the empirical tools that you use, because lots of gun scholars quote people, sometimes in context, sometimes out of context. It's often some work is done, I'm thinking about Jennifer Carlson's work, as more of an ethnography. You bring something very different to this from political science. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you chose the groups to study and which ones are looked at here in this book, and also how you decided to define communication, both what kinds of communication and when that communication took place.
Mm-hmm. Right. So to sort of support the argument, I have to demonstrate that the policy debate is warped, and therefore I have to look at the communications of interest groups. And so I chose 15 organizations to study, 9 gun control groups and 6 gun rights organizations. And I wanted to focus on national organizations and capture all of the major players at the federal level. So on the gun control side, some of the major groups are the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, and Every Town for Gun Safety. And then there are some there's some other organizations that are newer or more peripheral. So I wanted to get a sort of good diversity. So that includes the group called Gays Against Guns, which formed in the aftermath of the Pulse nightclub shooting, and Cure Violence, which is an organization that focuses on the way violence it sort of travels in a very similar way to an epidemic in communities, and really focuses on urban communities and stopping the spread of violence. So I tried to capture both the major players and some of the newer, more peripheral groups that perhaps have a little bit of a different approach. On the gun rights side, I only have 6 organizations, and that reflects the just sort of the difference in the policy community. So the NRA is the biggest organization, and there just isn't much room for other organizations, but there is some diversity. There is a group called the Gun Owners of America, which is a little bit more extreme. It calls itself the No Compromise Gun Lobby, the National Association for Gun Rights, and the Second Amendment Foundation, Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, and Students for Concealed Carry or Campus Carry. And the diversity on the gun rights side is a little bit more just ideological diversity. So that was the goal, was to sort of capture the main players at the federal level, and to look at sort of the intergroup dynamics and to examine the cohesion among groups on the same side of the issue. And then in terms of the communications I'm looking at, I'm also trying to capture the full scope of their communications. So I selected 4 different media in which groups communicate. So blog posts, emails, press releases, and Facebook posts. And I look at the period from 2000 to 2017 and just collected as many of these communications as I could from each of these organizations. So the total number of communications in the study is nearly 67,000. And that allows for a very powerful analysis, and it allows for me to generalize about the overall state of framing within the both the gun control side and the gun rights side, and a very full picture of how groups frame the issue. And then also, I look at this long time period, so I can sort of look over time at how the framing has shifted, and does it change in response to certain events, like the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, for instance. So the objective was to get as full a picture of the state of framing in the gun control and gun rights movements as possible.
We have some real quant jocks who listen to the podcast. And so can you just say a little bit about how you use this enormous data set to get the outcomes, what kinds of tools you were using to do the linguistic analysis?
Right. So I used automated computer content analysis to analyze all of the nearly 67,000 communications. And the way I used a program called Linguistic Inquiry and Word Count. And I like that program because it has sort of its own internal dictionaries, but it allows researchers to develop their own dictionaries. So, and by dictionary, I just mean a collection of key terms and phrases that are associated with different concepts. So I have a dictionary for different types of victims. So a dictionary that indicates when a communication references a victim's age, and a dictionary that captures when a communication mentions a victim's race, or a different a particular type of gun violence, like a mass shooting or an accidental shooting. So I built these numerous dictionaries, and then the computer did the hard work of identifying which communications contained these particular topics. And that gives an overall picture for how these topics appear in the frequencies that they do over time. But that loses some of the nuance. So to sort of supplement the automated content analysis, I would do sort of a deep dive into examples and really dig into and figure out, okay, when groups are talking about mental illness or terrorism in reference to the perpetrators of gun violence, what actually are they talking about? So I went back and I read through many of these blogs, emails, press releases, and Facebook posts just to get a sense, a picture of, okay, how are these topics being discussed? How, when race does come up, doesn't come up very often, but when it does come up, how are groups talking about it? So it's sort of a combination of this quantitative content analysis with the more qualitative contextual analysis of the topics and the ways that groups are using these topics.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
No, and I really appreciated the nuance with which you did that, mean, if you look at what, for example, somebody like Anton Scalia is doing in his analysis of past discussions of rights and policy, this idea of figuring out, well, what do people mean when they say a particular word, and are they using it ironically? Are they using it strategically? Has the meaning of the word changed? Are they changing the meaning of the words as they speak? And this is a really complex project that you've undertaken, and I just love the combination of the qualitative and the quantitative, and I found it so much more convincing than so much of what I have read about gun narratives because of that sophistication. So I love that part of the book. Thank you so much for all of that. Now, besides the quantitative, you are also bringing three really powerful qualitative frameworks to this. You use narrative policy, you use social construction of target populations, and critical race theory. And those are not, especially critical race theory, is not always integrated into these other approaches. So I was wondering if you could let us know, and not everybody is obviously a policy analyst, scholar, what each one is and how you're using them to help us better understand the distortion of the narratives.
Sure. So I draw on these three frameworks, the narrative policy framework, the social construction of target populations, and critical race theory. Probably the one that I rely on the most is the narrative policy framework. One of the things that I really like about the narrative policy framework is that it identifies structural elements that are common across contexts. So there is a setting there that includes a geographic location and a general context. There are characters, including heroes, villains, victims. There's a plot that connects them, and there's usually also a moral or a solution. And interest groups can use different narrative strategies depending on their goals and their position in the policy debate. One strategy that's very common is seeking to expand the scope of conflict, especially for groups that are or perceive themselves to be on the losing side of the issue. They will use narratives in ways that bring in more sympathetic participants to the policy debate to sort of question the status quo. So, for instance, let's say there's a mass shooting in a suburban elementary school in which white children are the predominant victims. That narrative is likely to hit home with sort of white suburban moms. They're likely to say, this could happen to my child and I should be afraid of that. And so that's a narrative that is very personally relevant to the audience and can bring in more participants. And then the opposite strategy is conflict containment. If you're happy with the status quo and you don't want to draw attention to the issue, make it seem distant. Emphasize settings that are far away and victims that are socially dissimilar and are victims that the audience you're appealing to would view as undeserving. So gun rights groups, for instance, who appeal to rural white gun owners might pursue this strategy by suggesting that gun crime is concentrated in urban areas. So there are different ways of putting narratives together to pursue these different strategies. So that's sort of the narrative policy framework. The social construction of target populations focuses on how elected officials design public policies to maximize their chances of winning re-election. And in particular, they will give benefits to groups that are positively socially constructed and burdens to groups that are negatively constructed. I sort of use this logic as a starting point, and I expand the framework to understand why groups focus on certain characters in their narratives. So if a group wants to elicit sympathy, it will focus on positively constructed characters like children. And if a group wants to elicit disgust, it will focus on negatively constructed characters like criminals. So this adds a little extra element to understanding why groups pursue particular narrative strategies. And then finally, with critical race theory, this is really to understand how race plays into the debate. The starting assumption is that racism is a persistent fact in American life. And I think in this current moment, more and more people are coming to this realization. And while overt racism may no longer be socially acceptable, white supremacy is still very much present. So critical race theorists uncover the different frames that are used to convey and reinforce white supremacy, often in subtle or covert ways. For example, the idea of abstract liberalism and the emphasis on individualism and equal opportunity, this notion that we get ahead by our own efforts, you know, this is a very commonly held view in the United States. And then, you know, by implication, if you have failed to progress in the labor market or in the educational arena, then that must be some fault of your own. And then another example would be the idea that we live in a colorblind society and we don't see people's race. We just see the other human beings. That sort of implies that we are, you know, we've moved beyond racism when in fact we know that there are many ways in which racism still plays out and impacts people's lives. So critical race theory helps to explain why groups rarely mention race. They're unlikely to use explicitly racist language because that is socially unacceptable, but then they're also unlikely to confront racism and to use anti-racist language. And the reason is that that could potentially offend their largely white constituencies. And a lot of people would prefer to avoid confronting racial issues. And I think that's probably why most of these groups have avoided openly discussing this for so long.
In the materials that you're reading, are the groups aware of the strategy of creating a narrative? Do they actively discuss, we should not say this, or we should use this word? Is that part of what can be revealed from their communication?
Yeah, I assume there is a great deal of intentionality in groups' framing choices. I have known people who work within interest groups and do advocacy, and they are very aware of the power of framing. So in a lot of cases, I think that they are making intentional choices about how to discuss the issue. But there can be some other factors that are involved. So for instance, the media has well-known biases, and the media disproportionately emphasizes mass shootings and white victims of violence. And so part of the group, you know, so then interest groups may simply sort of pick up and reinforce the dominant framing that is happening in the media. And there can be some, there may be some sort of unconscious processes also that are affecting how groups frame the issue that they potentially are not aware of. So the tendency to focus on, you know, white child victims, for instance, may reflect sort of an unconscious process that the groups are not explicitly sort of thinking about and, you know, making decisions about in their framing. But then also, these are strategic decisions that are made, but they are sort of day-to-day decisions, and they have sort of a cumulative effect over time. And so while I don't think groups are intentionally misleading, they're just sort of telling a version of the truth at one point in time. The end result, which likely is unintended, is that we over time tend to have a broader misperception of the issue. And that is just the result of these individual choices in framing that are made at particular points of time, in particular media.
You've been really a little bit too modest. So let me push you a little bit. You apply these three frameworks and you're very careful to show where you're getting these ideas and how you're building on the work of others. But can you outline a little bit more about how what you're doing is really pushing beyond what's done before to get to the sort of unique contribution of the work?
Well, I don't know that anyone else has examined such a large number of interest group communications from such a large population of groups. So there's a lot of work on the framing of gun policy, but most of it has focused on the media, and the research that has been done on interest groups has mainly focused on just a couple of organizations. So there are numerous studies that compare the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence to the National Rifle Association. So you really have a limited number of groups that have been subject to previous analyses. And then there's amazing prior work on gun politics and policy. I especially love Kristen Goss's book, Disarmed. I drew a lot of inspiration from her work. And she did some interesting participant observation attending the Million Mom March to really get a sense of what's going on within the gun control movement. But she didn't do a large scale content analysis of interest group communications. And so this really is the first study to examine such a large number of interest group communications in a diverse array of media, in particular social media and Facebook, this sort of a newer area of research. And then there's lots of research looking at the issue of race and gun politics, but nobody has so far systematically looked at, well, how do interest groups talk about race? Race and gun policy are so heavily intertwined, but no one prior to this had really said, okay, are groups mentioning race? Are they dealing with this? And if so, how?
Can you tell us just a little bit about how both sides are talking about race, of what the study reveals?
Sure. So this was really striking to me that it just was mentioned so infrequently. So for gun control groups, they mentioned race in about 6% of their blog posts, emails, and press releases. And in on Facebook, they mentioned it in just 1.5% of their Facebook posts. Gun rights organizations mentioned race even less frequently. So in about 4% of their non-Facebook communications and in less than 1% of their Facebook posts. So it's really hard to find instances of race coming up in these communications. So that to me is very striking. It shows that they are not addressing one of the major facets of the issue, given that racial minorities are really much more likely to be victims of gun violence than white people. And so the fact they're not talking about this in these forums is significant. So, and I chose these forums because these are the forums that groups use to conduct public outreach. In press releases, they're trying to shape broader public opinion. In their emails to their supporters, in their blog posts, they're really focusing on more of their core constituencies, but they're not educating people about the role of race in gun violence. What I also did find with respect to race is that while explicit discussions of the role of race were rare, I found that groups did use racial code words. So racial code words are words that evoke race in sort of subtle ways. So words like thug, street criminal, gang, and I also included the phrase dangerous people in this because there is sort of an implicit association between racial minorities and crime. So I found racial code words to be actually much more common. Somewhere around 35% of groups' non-Facebook communications, and in between 2.9 and 3.4% of their Facebook posts. And this is for both gun control and gun rights organizations. So while they don't explicitly talk about race, racial code is sort of implicit, which is somewhat problematic. Just using the phrase, let's keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people, or let's get the guns out of the hands of bad guys, for instance. These phrases don't explicitly discuss race, but because there is this association between race and crime, that using this crime control frame is somewhat problematic because it does evoke race.
Did you find one of the conclusions in the book is that both sides are using a strategy of conflict expansion? And I'm wondering, and you're saying that both sides also really are not attending to race. I'm wondering within the group of interest groups that you looked at on both sides, whether there were some variations. Are there some groups on either the gun safety or the gun rights side that do more genuinely care about race? Mm-hmm. Are there some that are less invested in conflict expansion and are looking for more compromise?
Yeah, so there is some significant important variation among the groups that I studied. And so on the gun control side, there are groups that really make it their business to look at the role of race. So the Violence Policy Center, which is a little bit more of a think tank, they regularly publish reports on Black homicide victimization, and that is easily searchable on their website, and they issue press releases on a very regular basis about that issue. And then some of the smaller groups like Cure Violence and Gays Against Guns, they're more willing to discuss the role of race in gun violence. The mainstream gun control groups, a little bit less so. So you just don't see it featured prominently in the communications of the Brady campaign, of Every Town for Gun Safety, in Americans for Responsible Solutions, which was renamed Giffords. You can find that information on their websites, but it's just not part of their everyday messaging that they put out through these various forums. And so in a way, it is encouraging that some groups are more explicitly discussing race, but they're smaller groups and they're more peripheral within the movement. And so there's a long way to go on the gun control side. And then there's definitely some variation within the gun rights side of the issue, although I find that the rhetoric on the gun rights side is a little bit more consistent and cohesive than it is on the gun control side. And some of the gun rights organizations are more willing to use more extreme language. So I give an example from a press release from the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. So they stated in reference to Illinois already has some of the strictest gun laws in the country, yet drug gangs thrive in the Windy City and its suburbs, and common street criminals don't have any trouble arming themselves. So that's a very deliberate use of racial code in that particular example to portray the issue in a particular way. So the NRA, in contrast to some of these groups, is probably actually considered more of the mainstream type of organization, and you won't see as much of this explicit racial code in some of their communications.
One of the things I loved about the book was the conclusion. So a lot of academics get to the end and they summarize what they found, but they don't necessarily expand thoughtfully on the implications of their work. This book ends really differently. It almost has two conclusions in which you really seriously address the policy and political implications of the work that you've done and the trends that you've observed. One of the things that jumped out at me was how you discussed the prospects for aligning with Black Lives Matter. And I'm wondering if you would talk a little bit about the advantages and obstacles to such an alignment, and also perhaps whether your analysis has changed since the book went to print, since our world has changed substantially since that time.
Right. So I do talk about one way in which either side on this issue could build a more diverse movement. So I'll just start with the gun control side and whether there is any possibility of aligning with Black Lives Matter. So it could be a way to bring in and build a diverse movement. And there seems to be sort of a common goal of reducing violence. And so what are the, you know, so that's sort of the why it makes sense side of the argument. But there are some obstacles as well. For instance, there are some people prominent in the gun control movement who have advocated for racialized policing policies. So the founder of the group that is now called Every Town for Gun Safety is former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg, who advocated a policy called Stop and Frisk, in which the majority of people targeted were Black or Latino. And then in addition, the gun control movement has also had a longstanding coalition with law enforcement dating to the 1970s. In the 1980s, gun control groups came out against cop killer bullets, which are capable of piercing body armor. And in the 1990s, the alliance with law enforcement was instrumental in helping pass the Brady Bill. And the Brady campaign represents police officers shot in the line of duty. So to align with Black Lives Matter might mean making a difficult decision, reassessing that relationship with law enforcement, because Black Lives Matter is about reducing violence against minorities at the hands of the state. So there would be some difficult choices, and perhaps these groups would lose some people but gain other supporters. But it's not just gun control groups who might think that this is a possibility or something that they would want to do. So gun rights organizations could also seek to appeal to Black gun owners and people who feel threatened, especially by law enforcement. What we are seeing now is that gun control groups are actually starting to make some moves in this direction, which I find really interesting. So I did check in with all of the groups in my book in terms of how they are responding to this current moment. And some of the mainstream groups, these are the groups that were most hesitant to mention race, are now coming out and saying that police violence is gun violence. So that's really, really interesting. And talking about how white supremacy is sort of impacting American life right now, and how we actually need to do something about it. We need to move away from militarized policing. So the Brady campaign has issued statements to this effect, as has Every Town for Gun Safety. And so these are the biggest and most mainstream gun control groups today. So I think that is really significant. It suggests that maybe groups are sort of moving in this direction. I'm not seeing that on the gun rights side. So the NRA has been pretty much silent on Black gun rights and advocating for the rights of people who have been victimized by the state. So I think that this is a really interesting moment, and we're seeing an evolution, especially on the gun control side, that potentially will lead to a more diverse movement in the future.
No, that's terrific. And this issue of police violence being gun violence, I think is something that has always been there. And you can see it as people are discussing this in the scholarly literature, but it hasn't had the kind of bright light shined on it that I think is necessary. I also wonder if there are potential alliances to be made between the gun control people and Black Lives Matter with regard to Stand Your Ground, which disproportionately affects citizens of color who are more likely to be shot and less likely to have self-defense upheld by a court. And that would be another possible alliance that could be made.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And these groups have been very critical of Stand Your Ground laws. In fact, they prefer to use the terminology shoot first laws, but recognizing that could be an area in which Black Lives Matter and gun control organizations work together, that there's a lot of potential there.
So there's so much in the conclusion and this book that I know we have not covered, but is there anything else that you want to leave listeners with before we talk about actually what you're doing now?
I don't know. I think we've covered many of the main ideas in the book.
Okay. Well, tell me what you're doing now. I know this book just came out in 2020, but have you started a new project? Are you thinking about a new project?
Right. After I finished this book, I did decide to step away from gun policy for the time being, because it is emotionally draining. It is just a difficult subject to study. It's depressing. There's no getting around that. My current research is I moved to look at healthcare policy, in particular, the expansion of, Medicaid in the states, after the Affordable Care Act. So, I'm sort of keeping the common thread, which is examining framing, and looking at how people discuss Medicaid and the people who are the beneficiaries of Medicaid. And using the case study of Kentucky, which for a couple of years, there was a proposal by the governor to roll back the expansion of Medicaid. And there was a public comment period, and thousands of people submitted public comments. And what me and my co-author Kathy Colville are doing, we're looking at how people socially construct beneficiaries, and especially the beneficiaries themselves. So while I focused on interest groups quite heavily in my previous research, now the focus is sort of shifting in our research here to the targets, the people who are going to be affected by public policies, and how they frame the issue and how they frame themselves as recipients. Are they seeking to shift or change the predominant social construction of people who receive Medicaid or receive public assistance in some way? So it's the same idea of framing and how framing can be used to shape public opinion, but looking at it from the perspective of the individuals who are impacted by public policy.
Well, that just sounds fascinating. And I'll just note that you've moved from the emotionally draining and depressing study of the environment to the emotionally draining and depressing gun violence, and now on to hardly a cheery subject of healthcare. So
right.
you certainly are picking the things that are in the crosshairs of American politics and policy. This is a terrific book. It is Warped Narratives, Distortion in the Framing of Gun Policy by Melissa K. Mary, available from the University of Michigan Press. You can find it on the University of Michigan Press website or online, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. I am encouraging people personally to check out bookshop.org, which allows you to buy your book from a brick and mortar store and have it shipped directly to you, trying to help out the brick and mortars during the pandemic. Melissa, thank you so much for coming to share the book, and best of luck with the next project.
Okay, thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about my research.